third House Finance come to order. We have members present who represent Edgemond, Dugan, Stoltz, T. Wilson, and Guttenberg. We're not going to be taking any business. We'll start short of a quorum in order to respect the time of yourselves and audience and our esteemed commissioners. So, we have two departments who have connected over to us today, Department of Education and the folks that are funding Department of Education revenue. We'll start. And Representative Costello has joined us. Any comments, questions before we start? Welcome, Commissioner Hanley.
Great. Thank you, Chair Stoltz, members of the House Finance Committee. For the record, my name is Mike Hanley. I am the Commissioner for the Department of Education and Urban Development. And with me is Mark Lewis, our Acting Director of Administrative Services. Today I'd like to review with you our mission, our core services, and how our budget aligns with those. The Alaska Constitution clearly states for the Education Department that we have a responsibility to establish and maintain a public school system for all kids in the state. Moving towards our policy, we move from a school-wide view down to a child-centered view, where we have an expectation that all of our kids will be successful both in their education and in their work. That includes a recognition of who they are within their own community and their larger society and the role that they play and the way that they can have a positive impact beyond the school doors. Our bottom line, as our mission statement says on this slide, is to ensure quality standards-based instruction to improve academic achievement for all students. And we have had, over the last several years, the opportunity to have all three branches of government weigh in on just what that means for the Department of Education and what are our responsibilities and our obligations to our kids in the state. The first one is to develop and provide student standards. And I am pleased to say that when I sat here almost a year ago, and I was a little nervous about saying it, but I said, by next year I'll have a new set of standards for you. We have a new set of standards that have gone out to the State Board of Education that are currently out for public comment. So a lot of work has gone into that. It changes several things from previously they were K-10, now they go all the way up to 12th grade. They have raised the bar to recognize what our kids need to do to be successful not only in their own communities and our own state, but across the United States. So I'm happy about that. Another core mission that we have is that we have to have assessments that adequately measure how our kids are doing in regards to those standards. Accountability and oversight is a third one, a responsibility that in a state that relies heavily on local control, local districts to make decisions on how children are taught, that we have, we provide the oversight and support and accountability for those districts that are struggling to offer what their kids have a constitutional right to in their education. And we also offer several statewide educational programs to support the mission of local districts for their kids. Statewide programs include mentoring, professional development for teachers and administrators, pre-K. We also have federal funding that works through our Teaching and Learning Support Division and offers school improvement grants as well as our state system of support. Our budget is basically broken down into two categories. We have the K-12 formula funding and the agency fund. And you can see here that of a budget of about $1.6 billion, that 95% of it, about $1.3 billion, is the K-12 formula. The agency operations make up about 5% of the overall budget. The pie chart here recognizes the sources of those funds, 84% of it being general funds, 14% being federal funds, and 2% representing other funds, such as interagency receipt, MTAR monies comes from the Mental Health Trust. Looking at this graph, This shows an overview of our operating budget, and it shows how our money goes out the door. Only 2% of this budget is personal services, with 3% representing our other contractual responsibilities, commodities, and a very small part of that is travel as well. 95% incorporates the foundation formula, pupil transportation, school debt reimbursement, Title I programs, and ARRA funding. In the lower left-hand corner, you will see that our department employs 332 full-time people, 14 part-time, 8 non-perm. That includes Mount Edgecombe teachers, because Mount Edgecombe is the one state-run school. So that includes the staff at Mount Edgecombe. It also includes the staff at the Commission on Post-Secondary Education. This slide is just a general, very general slide, the simplified view of those two portions, of 95% being the K-12 formula and 5% being the agency. And it's broken up in the upcoming slide here. Using the pie chart from the previous slide that's on the left, that's just a mirror image of what was there on the other slide. This is a slide that, without the foundation funding, into this diagram. Note that the small red slice on the left-hand side, the 5% agency operations, actually translates into the blue slice of the 21% of it as general funds. Probably the most significant thing to notice here is that of our agency operations, a majority of the funding is federal funding. You'll see that 71% of it is federal funding, with only 21% coming from general funds. So the state is not the main driver in the agency funding of our department. The structure for our department is slightly different than the structure of most of the other ones. The head of our department is the State Board of Education and Early Development. They appoint a commissioner. And then we have, you'll see, our five main divisions within there. Also includes, which is not commonly thought of, libraries, archives, and museums, Mount Edgecombe Boarding School. Our largest one is the one on the left there, teaching and learning support, which drives directly towards our core mission. The three down below don't have lines connected to them for specific reasons. Those are boards and commissions that they have their own boards or commissions that they report to. So they are within our department. We provide administrative services for these, but we don't directly control them. And that's the Professional Teaching Practices Commission, State Council on the Arts, and the Commission on Post-Secondary Education. This next slide breaks down that 95% that I've been referring to into what that looks like. Again, you'll see that the foundation program is a major part of what we do. Boarding home grants, that includes schools like Nanana, Galena, Mount Edgecombe. It also supplies boarding opportunities for students who are in a community that doesn't have a high school. Youth in detention, those are programs like McLaughlin. There's also another one in Juneau and another one up north. There are several in the state. We provide educational services for kids who are incarcerated. Special schools includes API, School for the Deaf and Hard of Hearing, and CESA, which is a special education service agency. That's not a school, but a service agency that provides support for special education services around the state. And the Alaska Challenge Youth Academy, that is the military academy. We provide aims to the academy of students who have dropped out. They do their best to reincorporate them into a program that provides success for them. Most of these students move on to get GEDs. But we have seen tremendous impacts there of lives just turned around. Students have dropped out that are really on the edge of just dropping out more than just school. They're just dropping out of society and seeing their lives turned around. But you'll see the agency portion.
Yeah. Questions?
Yes. Thank you. Commissioner Hanley, can you go back to the Military Youth Academy? Totally understand the mission and the success and appreciate it. Is there any direct coordination with the Office of Children's Services to try and draw some of the youth who would benefit there into the Military and Youth Academy? Any real direct coordination?
Not direct concerted effort in that regard, no. We largely get the population from the students who have dropped out.
I don't know of any first-hand coordination efforts to what you're speaking to.
Just a follow-up, Mr. Chair. As you know, the graduation rates for foster youth are not good. And the sort of homes that foster youth end up in are not as good in many cases as living in a structured environment like you provide. And I'm wondering if you would consider coordinating with the Office of Children's Services to...
Gary, that would not be hard to do. We could surely do that. We're hoping that most of the kids that are in have been referred to OCS. If they're still in school, they're still focused on the primary focus of a degree and a diploma. Most of the kids at the Military Academy have even stepped out a further step and are focused on GED. But it doesn't mean that there aren't a few of the kids that are in between that are a function of OCS that have also dropped out.
Just finally, future. There are a lot of youth at OCS who also fall off the school track, so obviously not the ones that are still matriculated in school. But if you could coordinate with them, that would be a great benefit, I think.
Thank you, Representative Muir. Representative Dugan.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I'm still on the same page there, which says pupil transportation of about $62 million. And it says K-12 formula programs. What is the formula for student transportation?
Through the chair, Representative Dugan, it's in the statute, and it's based on the population of each school district. If you wanted the exact formula, I'd have to refer back to the statute to get that for you.
Okay. Yeah, if you would. I'm just curious to know how much of this $62 million goes where and how much, if this is matched in any way, and if so, how. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
It doesn't meet all the needs, and there are folks that want us to revisit it, as the Commissioner's aware.
Representative and Vice Chair Fairclough.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Hanley, doesn't individual school districts that qualify receive direct appropriations from the federal government for pupil transportation, and this is a supplemental to school districts?
Through the chair, Representative Fairclough, this is actually the bulk of their state support for the pupil transportation program. I could ask the school finance director to clear up if there is some federal funding involved too, but it's my understanding that this is their main source of funding for pupil transportation in the state of Alaska.
Mr. Chairman, the reason I was trying to follow up with that is when I first came to this body, I suggested that we could lower pupil transportation costs and increase ridership on bus transportation if we started migrating some of the youth in higher grade levels onto the public transportation system. You would create transportation. The reason I was told we couldn't do that was because we had to have yellow school buses and they had to be so far above a railroad track to qualify for reimbursement. If that's not the case, the federal government is not hinging to that, then the other issue is back on the table. So I'd like to know, I thought that there was a substantial portion, at least in past years when I served on the Anchorage Assembly, of federal money coming in for pupil transportation. But again, if that's dropped off, it would be something this body needs to know.
If I may, invite Elizabeth Newman to the table, Director of School Finance, if she can probably address that.
Thank you. For the For the record, I'm Elizabeth Nittleman, Director of School Finance. And through the chair, as long as I have known, there is not federal funding for the People Transportation Program. It is a state-funded program. And the $62 million is dispersed throughout the school districts. The formula is a per-dollar amount calculated for each district multiplied by the number of students in the district. So it is a formula calculation. The program runs underneath federal standards. So there are some federal requirements to running the school buses. But again, the funding is at the state level. And I'd be happy to follow up with more information.
I'll make an inquiry to Anchorage School District to see how they cut their pie. On previous budget hearings at least a decade ago, there was a cut that showed coming in from the federal government. So you're not aware that they're receiving an additional funding stream from the federal government to support people transportation.
Through the chair, thank you. And I will go back and you may have information that I'm not aware of. Thank you.
Yes. And it is, it's an issue that you probably will hear more from urban legislators, especially from the Sprouta districts and rurals where the schools are more concentrated. So there sometimes ends up a little tinge of politics in the issue because it's not universally applied to everybody. It's one of those areas where urban areas have a higher need for funding. That's how we strike balance around here. Well, we have a full complement of the committee now with the co-chair arriving.
On the next slide, looking at educational support services, these are our agency operations broken down, again representing about 2% of our agency budget. In this budget includes the commissioner's office, admin services, IT, school finance, capital improvement projects, and our centralized services in general. The State Board of Education, the cost for them is also a function of the executive administration budget. Teaching and learning support is by far our largest division, and appropriately so. It has a focus directly on student and school achievement. And you'll see that is actually broken out there at the top as being the largest component of teaching and learning services. We also have in TLS, the state system of support, which provides our coaches in our intervention districts. Statewide mentoring program, which works to provide support for all first and second year teachers. We've seen tremendous impact from our mentorship program, with not only a higher rate of retention, but a higher rate of student achievement for teachers who have been, for the students in classes with teachers who have been mentored in their first or second years compared to those who weren't. Teacher certification, child nutrition is also there. Child nutrition is a function of USDA. And we also have our early learning coordination, which includes support for programs like Best Beginnings, Parents as Teachers, in our pre-K program.
Representative T. Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you tell me how many contracts there are, personal contracts, that fall underneath teaching and learning personnel?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, the last time I looked, that particular unit had about 118 professional services contracts. I do feel it's important to make a distinction that the executive branch agency does not contract for employees. Each one of these professional services contracts has to go through a procurement process, and there are issues with risk management and liability issues if they were considered employees, and there are also personnel rules. So the way to define what we call a professional services contract is we hire a vendor to perform a specific scope of work, and they can use however many people they need to provide that service to us, but we don't really track it on the individual basis as one contract means one person. That's not the intent of professional services contract as we execute them.
Follow-up, sir? But specifically on the mentor system, you do have contracts with individuals to do the mentoring. Now, you may have other contracts, like I said, for mentoring that you hire out, but the mentoring and the specialists that you have, the content coaches, are a one-on-one contract where you're contracting that person to do a specific detail.
But through the chair, Representative Wilson, you are correct on those, the mentors and the coaches. That is correct. And not all of them work full-time. They are paid a certain amount for the specific scope of work, but they're not all considered full-time.
Thank you.
We also have the component of our department called commissions and boards. This does not include our state board of education. It does only include Professional Teaching Practices Commission and the Alaska State Council on the Arts, and represents a very, very small part of our budget. Mount Edgecombe Boarding School is the only state-run school we have. It's located in Sitka. It currently has just about 400 students in there, representing 110 communities across the state. They currently have over 10,000 alumni, and 95% of them are Alaska Native. So it is definitely a model of success that we've seen in the state. Our state facilities maintenance budget. The first part is just our interagency receipts. As a matter of fact, when you look at the 1.152 state facilities maintenance, that is actually an interagency receipt request from Mount Edgecombe, and it is actually incorporated into the previous number that you saw for Mount Edgecombe, not in the dollar two. For the state facilities rent, that includes rent for the Gold Belt building that we have our office in here in Juneau, the Talking Books Library in Anchorage, storage facility for our archives, as well as library space in the state office building. We previously had office space rented in the Atwood building as well. Shortly after I came on board, we chose to let that go, and now when I work out of Anchorage, I've got a little corner that I work out of the state, the Talking Books Library. So just to maximize those facilities. The libraries, archives, and museums.
Is that typical housing for most commissioners? I just want to congratulate your austerity. We've had some commissioners in the past that have viewed office space as pretty important. And I'll just leave it at that. I appreciate your prioritization.
Well, thank you. And obviously, if we did have a meeting that required a space, and we can always go and use the Atwood building, but my cubicle with a computer and a printer and access to the internet does the job for me. Thank you. Libraries, archives, and museums, also an important function of the Department of Education. They do a tremendous job with educational work. Just over 4% of our budget. They provide public library assistant grants to libraries across the state, as well as our archives containing a lot of the original artifacts and documents to the history of our state, including the original Constitution. The Alaska Commission on Postsecondary Education services student loans and is now key to heading up our Alaska Performance Scholarship, which both of those, the loans and the scholarship, are critical for our kids to be able to access post-secondary education. So regarding the Alaska Performance Scholarship Awards, we currently there's been $6 million allocated for that. In this budget, we're asking for an additional $2 million. And it is based on the estimates that we project for the number of recipients this coming year at 2,340, and an average award of just over $3,400. This comes out to just about $8 million. This last year, we reached the goal that we had for the number of students that would qualify, which was just under 30%. We were happy about that. Slightly disappointed with the number that actually accepted it. We still had a lot of kids going outside to other universities. We've attributed that after conversations with families and with students to a lot of them being a new program, already had things in place, already had their minds set. We would anticipate seeing an increase in the number of qualifiers actually take advantage of the scholarship in the coming year.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Hanley, as I recall, though maybe it's just wishful thinking, and maybe I don't recall it, but as I recall, there was sort of a two-thirds, one-third split between the performance scholarship and merit-based scholarship. Maybe it was 3-1, I don't remember. But did you also award needs-based scholarships last year on that formula?
Not as a part of the performance scholarship. That funding mechanism is still in play during this legislative session on how that would be allocated.
Through the chair. So I thought that was in the budget. Was there not
Alaska money? Advantage still provided awards to the Alaska Advantage program. Diane can clarify that, and Barron's can clarify that if you'd like.
Yeah, I just want to see if my recollection is correct or if the money wasn't in the budget. I thought it was.
Ms. Barron's like to come up. We generally invite the people up here.
Thank you. For the record, Diane Barron's Executive Director of the Alaska Commission on Postsecondary Education. Through the Chair, Representative Guerra, in the FY12 budget, there was a $3 million general fund appropriation. All of those funds were expended. We made slightly more than 2,000 awards in FY12.
Thank you.
Well, Ms. Barron's is here. Anybody escaped? please proceed, Mr. Hanley.
I'll look at the next slide in regards to the governor's budget highlights, meeting our mission in regards to our standards and our assessment obligations to our kids. For our content standards, the first item there, an aligned assessment system is important for us to be able to measure how our kids are doing in regards to where we want them to be. We've had continual increases in cost, and there are incremental increases that take place as a part of our contract, and there is a request for $750,000 to meet those contractual needs to continue our assessment protocol. $750,000 is only a small portion of the overall budget that we have for our assessment system, though. We also, last year, began the Alaska Learning Network. Is an online distance delivery model that not only will have a huge impact around the state for kids to offer to access additional courses, but also to access courses that will directly impact their ability to take advantage of the performance scholarship. That program, we initially went out to all of our superintendents and said, what courses would you like to see in this model? What courses would help your students access the scholarship? And so we used their input to develop the first 19 courses. So we're excited about that. We currently have 16 districts taking advantage of that. And for the second semester, we have upped that to 22 courses.
Sam Fairclough.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, are we working with the University of Alaska to coordinate and stand up those online programs, or are you doing that internally to the Department, the State's Department of Education?
We have a contract that, with Chatham School District, which is the financial agent, to run that, and they've contracted with Woody Wilson and the Wrangell School District to actually run that. So we originally approached the university because they already had some things in place. And at their request, we decided not to move forward with that. So we're not currently working direct. ACLIN, the Alaska Learning Network, is not directly connected to the university at this time.
Were they responsive to your request?
Yes, there was excitement with different individuals, but getting them all on the same page proved to be difficult for them. So we did make an effort. We actually thought we were getting very close to that.
Wilson and Dugan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So as you add more communities to it, will that increase the cost of it, or is the initial cost just to put the courses together?
We don't anticipate adding more cost to this. The course development is a big portion of that cost. Scholarships to these districts is another part of the cost for students to access it. So we don't anticipate this cost going up. A class is being offered. More students can access it without increasing the $1.2 million.
Also, since this was used with stimulus money, and we basically made it clear in the legislature that we weren't going to keep doing things that were done by stimulus, have you thought about looking within the department to see where else this might be able to be funded?
We have looked at different avenues, but one of our visions is to recognize the changing tide of technology in education and the need to incorporate that. And so we've got a definite model that we put into place in this regard, and we did begin it with our funds. Our goal all along has been to continue this program, especially when we saw the results that we had last year, is to continue the model. But we don't have the ability within our department now, within our RGF, that 5% to be able to offer the program.
And one final question, sir. I know another part of this, since they have the base student allocation, is there any kind of plan, since students will be taking this, of charging the districts a certain fee to distribute evenly to take care of the cost versus it being free for whatever districts are currently taking place?
Currently there is a scholarship for every student who wants to take a course. So it's only costing districts, it is costing districts, I think, about $150 per course, per seat. So the idea is we have the Learning Network contracts, in a sense, or works directly with school districts, not with students. Students then have support from both ends. They have a highly qualified teacher at the Alaska Learning Network side, as well as support from their school. It doesn't change the daily membership. It doesn't change student enrollment. But for a small fee, districts can offer additional courses that they wouldn't be able to offer in-house.
Thank you.
Representative Thomas, and then
David. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair, for taking over too. Just in follow-up, Representative Wilson, in regards to the ERA money, I think we've told everybody statewide that when it comes to education, that money wouldn't be replaced with the general fund, so we want to be very explicit. I think if we make a change, we'll have 1,000 people locking out the doors. You did it. We've seen the playgrounds, and so I'm just a little worried about people lining up from here all the way down to the airport, coming in with their handout also. So I think we had this discussion, but I want to be on record, making people know that everybody was told not to look for general funds if you started a new program.
Right. Thank you, Rep. Thomas. When we originally looked at putting this together, I guess maybe the flaw is that we did not come and look for funding immediately elsewhere. Because it has been a vision for us to include that as a part of the educational system in Alaska. So we did take advantage of those funds. It's still a vision we have to allow technology to be the equalizer of opportunity around the state. But we are looking for funds to continue that program. We should evaluate it.
Thank you. And thank you for your patience, Representative Dugan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, and sorry. On bullet 2, it says that there is an aligned assessment system. I think I know what an assessment system is, but I don't know what an aligned assessment system is. Could you help me?
Our first responsibility is to set a goal for kids, and those are our state standards, our student standards. From there, we have a responsibility to say, are we getting there? Are our kids getting what they need to access those standards? That's their constitutional right. So we have developed benchmark assessments that start in third grade and go through 10th grade to measure kids' growth towards those standards. So all of those assessments are in alignment with the goal of proficiency on the standards.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Clear to you now, Representative Bizer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I understand now 40% of it, I believe.
Representative Fairclough.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Somewhat on the same vein, Commissioner. You held up a purple packet that said you're out for review on 11 and 12 state standards. Is that correct?
Right.
And do those standards then meet the entry level for University of Alaska on entrance exams?
Through the chair, and I apologize for you, but through the chair, we anticipate so, yes. As a matter of fact, the university system will be actually vetting these standards to assure us that they truly are preparing kids to enter college without needing remediation.
Mr. Chairman, if I might.
Representative Fairclough.
Commissioner Hanley, was the university involved in the process of building them, or they're just out for review and we're going to modify them after we hear what the university has to say about them?
Through the chair, the university has been involved throughout the process. They've been worked on for about the last 2 years. February of 2010 is when we first began developing those, and we've had representatives from the university system involved all along.
Thank you.
Representative Jewell.
Good afternoon. So, if a student, once we get these standards in place for 11th and 12th, were to go through that, implement them, students are meeting that level of standards, do you think then we would be able, as students enroll into our university system, to bypass the sub 100 level coursework?
Through the chair, Representative Jewell, we definitely want to avoid the 055 courses, the below the sub 100, yes. Would they be able to bypass the 100 level courses? Is that what you were asking?
No.
Or just the sub 100?
Would they essentially not have to take bonehead math, English, and everything else that some of them currently have to take when they get in?
Sure, that is absolutely our goal. When we talk about having our kids prepared beyond high school for college and careers, a student that needs several courses of remediation would not suggest that they are really prepared for a college or a career. So, yes, that's our goal.
Remedial work is really the word I was looking for, not bonehead.
I understand.
Too big a word.
Representative Fairclough.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Could you tell us, if you know the answer, the courses that are currently online that you've provided to the rest of the state as your beginning portfolio for access to all students?
Through the Alaska Learning Network? I don't have the list with me, but we have got Spanish 1 and 2, German 1 and 2, we've got algebra, we've got calculus, we've got Alaska Studies. We have a couple other math courses as well. I don't have the complete list.
St. Thomas.
Thank you, Ms. Kosher. Question, Commissioner, in regards to Alaska Performance Scholarship, and just since Representative Jewell brought up bonehead math and English, if these are scholars, are we paying if they have to? I'm not assuming they're taking them, but if I was a recipient and I go to the university and I have to take bonehead math and English, is our performance scholarship funds paying for that? Or are we not paying for it? I mean, it seems like we wouldn't pay for it if they're our best. If that makes any sense to you.
Yes, it does. I'm happy to report, and I know the report is coming out, that after the 1 year of the performance scholarship, we have seen a significantly less need for qualifiers of the performance scholarship to take remedial classes. Let me say it another way, that our recipients of the scholarship are taking fewer courses that are remedial than non-qualifiers are. But currently there's no separation, and the scholarship will still pay for courses that need to be taken that are below the 100 level.
So fewer of our honor students have to take remedial classes.
Yes. We'll leave that rhetorical.
Go ahead, Representative Haley.
Okay. Moving down to the next one, we've touched on it briefly, is to fully fund year two of the Alaska Performance Scholarship at $2 million. We are continuing with our state system of support as one of our core services of oversight and accountability. And that will provide, currently we have 22 content coaches that are out in our districts to provide the support, as well as one trustee. The statewide literacy program, we have been looking significantly at what it's going to take for our kids to be successful in third grade. It tends to be the benchmark that everybody uses. Our kids need to be able to read by the time they're in third grade so that they can use that tool to then learn. So we're looking at strengthening that early system. Last year we had the first year of a literacy institute that provided training for not only our kindergarten teachers and our early education teachers, but also our preschool teachers. We invited Head Start teachers and other teachers that were providing programs in communities and in districts to come and work with school staff on strategies to help our kids access and gain the knowledge that they need to be literate by third grade. So that is part of it. We are also go ahead.
Representative Bureau.
Oh, yeah, I didn't want to interrupt, though, but should I ask the question now?
Go ahead. No.
We need to check the sound system.
Please, why don't you go ahead? I've already broken the cadence, so
okay. Jump right in. How do I say this politely? Just following up on some of the prior questions, can you remind me to qualify for the performance-based scholarship? Is the lowest grade you can get a C, or is it a C plus?
2.5.
So that's a C, right?
Yeah, middle C. Twos are low Cs, threes are low Bs.
So Representative Thomas asked, you know, how many of the people we're granting the scholarship to are taking remedial courses, some number. I've always had a question about telling students, hey, we've got a scholarship program, shoot for a C, right? That doesn't seem to be the greatest message. Are there other, do you envision ever changing the qualification to something other than a C, number one? And number two, you would know more than I do, are there other states that grant this performance scholarship, the sort of shoot for a C scholarship, or do they use higher grades?
We are definitely not trying to advocate that shooting for a C is where to go. It's tiered, so you can get one level of funding at a C, you can get a higher level of funding at a B, and you can get a higher level of funding at an A, at 3.5. Where we think that this program will have the most impact, those kids that are at the 3.5s to 4.0s, they're going to be there with or without a scholarship, I would anticipate. They are kids that have the support they need and the ability to move forward. A lot of them will be going to college anyway. We would hope that this scholarship will keep them in the state where we think it will have an impact. And on those kids that are on the edge, it says, you know, I'm just not that good at school. I'm not going to go to college. And then suddenly realizing that if they apply themselves and they take the set of rigorous courses, even if they don't get A's and B's, they have taken the set of rigorous courses. And that's probably more the set of rigor rather than the GPA. If they've taken that set of courses necessary to qualify, that they'll be prepared and they'll receive money. So we are really hoping that middle student will be the one that benefits the most.
I understand. Not necessarily agree, but I understand. Thank you.
It's kind of like in the law profession, they say the judges are the A students, and so those are the C students are the ones that go out and they're better at catching ambulances.
I'm not sure. I missed that. I immediately got defensive when you said law students. So.
No, that was a light moment, not intended to throw gasoline. Anyway.
Trust me, I don't practice law anymore for some of those reasons.
So in the middle of your sentence where you were.
Yes, continuing with the literacy program. We talked about the Literacy Institute. We are also recognizing the fact that parents have a key role in helping their kids be successful and be ready for kindergarten. And so we have put together a set of what we have begun to brand as I am ready skills. And they're not necessarily academic skills. There are some academic skills in here that we are working currently to get these with a publisher, to get them out to every place a parent might be who has young children. So that would include schools, but also healthcare clinics and pediatricians and hospitals and all of those, so that we can empower the parents to say, ah, these are what I need to know, this is what my child needs to know to help them be successful, to empower parents early on. We also anticipate that this $300,000 will support a ready-to-read program, which we work through our library and provides bags of books. Parents can sign up, get a bag of books delivered to them for early literacy. So it's to really support those early functions to help our kids gain what they need by third grade.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you. The way you described it, it almost sounds like you're competing with Best Beginnings, which seems to be a pretty successful program. Was there some kind of thought of working with them versus reinventing a new program?
We do work directly with Abby at Best Beginnings, and I don't think she would consider it competition. We have not developed this program. We've accessed it, and Best Beginnings provides a book a month, and it's a great program, and we obviously support them. This is just another avenue to reach more parents.
Thank you.
And the last item on there is the Early Learning Coordination Pre-K program. Previously called our pilot, we recognize we've now got 3 years of pretty solid data and the impact it's had on kids, the value that it's had. We're excited to see what it's done. It's moved a lot of kids from the lowest quartile up to the highest quartile. We've seen 78% of the kids actually increase more than a year's growth in our preschool programs. We're excited about that, getting them on track. So the $700,000 is to continue to support that program.
Representative Edgman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In about 3 weeks, the Head Start folks are going to be in town, and I generally meet with those that are from my district and maybe the broader Southwest area. Every year I get asked the same question. Why don't they get it? You know, our program is so successful in terms of educating kids at a younger age, giving them support and the help that they need before they get into school, and the data seems to overwhelmingly support that. My question to you would be, do you envision somewhere down the road that the department would play a bigger role in terms of early learning than it does today, vis-a-vis some of the studies that's going on? I know there's also some data work that's being compiled as well outside the agency now. But do you see that down the road?
Representative Edgman, I think you'll get to determine if we have a greater role in early literacy and early education. We're huge supporters of Head Start. They do a tremendous job. These are not designed to compete, to duplicate, but to meet the needs of more families. And Head Start does a nice job. They do a nice wraparound job. Head Start, in its essence, is not necessarily academically focused. They do great wraparound services, which our kids need, but are not necessarily aimed for having kids being prepared for kindergarten. Some of them are, but not necessarily. So I look forward to continuing to work with Head Start. And again, I think these are supportive in having us to work from different angles to meet the needs of most families and most kids.
Maybe just a quick follow-up, Mr. Chairman. So to broaden my question out to early learning, I'll rephrase my question by asking, do you see the department maybe even a year or two down the road being more involved overall in early learning in terms of what it does today?
Through the chair, we recognize the value of early learning. Originally, when we had our pilot pre-K put in place, the goal was to have $2 million a year and add $2 million a year until we had a $10 million program. So that is a vision. We recognize how to strengthen the need to strengthen our kids. There's a lot of data on how many kids walk into kindergarten unprepared. The one thing that we do have that helps us with that is to recognize we've got a developmental profile of all kindergartners take when they come into public schools.
And I appreciate there's just this is probably many, many more fold folks that don't fly down here in Juneau and aren't as interested in their kids being grabbed at an earlier age for socialization process. And that's as much as this has been described yet. And I hear from that group pretty vocally as well. And so there's two poles on this. They just don't get plane tickets to fly down to Juneau. Representative Jewell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The request this year is for an additional $700,000 in that line item. Is that correct? Is the way I'm seeing this on the early learning coordination?
Through the chair, Representative Jewell, the $700,000 was a one-time item. We did have $2 million in the budget. We currently have $1 million in the base. This was turned to a $700,000. One-time item, so we have to. It comes out of the budget, and then we have to put it back in by requesting it, just to get to the current level of funding. So it's not in addition to the $2 million that was previously in the base. It's just restoring it back to the levels, which includes the other $300,000 that Senator Hoffman put in for the intervention districts. And so the total would be $2 million once again.
Representative Garrett.
I appreciate that in your terms, you're huge supporters of Head Start. There was one year under Governor Palin that we were able to work with her to increase funding for Head Start. And to my recollection, that's the only increase in state funding that Head Start has received in a decade. Maybe there was a second year, but if you're huge supporters of Head Start, does that reflect it in your budget anywhere? Or are they receiving the same amount of money as last year?
Through the chair, Representative Gara, the reality of it is that any proposal that the Department of Education puts out has to be within the context of what the governor has for priorities that year. Not that this wouldn't be a priority, but just within that context, we may not always be able to add funding for any particular program. And so I think that's what you're seeing. It's not a lack of support. It's just within the level of funding and the priorities that come out. We have to support what the governor has put out for his FY13 request.
Just a follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Representative Garrett.
That didn't answer my question, and it might have been unintentional, but my understanding is we're not putting any more money into the pre-K pilot program, even though that was supposed to increase as we proved it worked, and we're not putting any money into Head Start above last year's level, and this will be yet another year of no increase to Head Start. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Vera, that is correct.
Representative Costello.
Thank you, Commissioner. Do we know how many third graders in Alaska are reading at grade level?
It depends on what assessment we use. It's relatively high. It's in the 70% range if we use our standards-based assessment.
That's high. 30%.
Well, 70%.
I don't know.
When we look across the country, 70% is relatively high. But we also need to recognize that the cut score we have on our SBAs is not particularly high. It is not necessarily a true recognition of proficiencies. So when we compare our third grade test to then what happens in fourth grade, we see it drop significantly. And we see it drop down in the 40s.
Commissioner, do we have any research that shows a link between reading at grade level as a third grader and overall school success?
There are a lot of studies done. I'd like to grab those for you. I don't have anything.
Thank you.
Representative Dugan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, I want to get back to your previous answer, which I'm going to try and restate so that I understand it. excuse me. I'm sorry, I can't actually do this, I don't think. Anyway, give me your previous answer again, please. That's the best way to do it.
To represent
me? To represent?
Yes.
So, in regards to how many students are tested at proficient at third grade?
Right, thank you. In which you said, I believe, that a bunch of them test at third grade and then drop off in fourth grade?
And thank you, Senator Chair. Thank you for allowing me to clarify that. The assessments that we have now, the standards-based assessments that we have now, show our kids making steady growth. When we use a different assessment tool, in this case, there's a tool that we do every other year, and it's called the NAEP test. It's a national test. And granted, it is a more rigorous test, and it doesn't test necessarily the exact same thing, but that test shows our kids are not nearly as proficient as our standards-based assessment does. So I think somewhere between where our standards-based assessment is and what this other test is probably where our real level of proficiency is.
Mr. Chairman, if I might. If we're having that much of a drop-off, why don't we change the testing for the standards-based test?
We will have new, through the chair, we'll have new assessments that go with our new standards. But it is not necessarily a flaw in the assessment. It may be an erroneous, it could be argued, an erroneous cut score to say that a score of 300, which is currently what our cut score is, it's just a raw number. It doesn't necessarily mean anything out of context. But a score of 300 is really not an adequate cut score. Maybe a child should have a 330 or a 340 before we say they're proficient. Does that make sense?
Mr. Chairman, yeah, it does. But I guess what I'm trying to figure out here, maybe there's a way to ask this question. How did those scores compare with any nationally administered tests that we're aware of?
Through the chair, there's only one nationally administered test, and that is the NAEP. It's given in fourth and eighth grade every other year across the country. And that is really the only tool we have to compare ourselves with other states. And we are near the bottom when we compare all 50 states. And I have to look again at fourth grade rating. I think we might be 45th.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I represent Bettenberg and then represent Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Perhaps this is part of why, at least I am kind of stumbling on this proficiency rating at third grade is in a drop-off at fourth grade, is because in other briefings that we sit in on, the number of prisoners with a third grade reading level is really high in our prisons. And, you know, we're just kind of looking at this as a holistic issue. You know, if we could bring up the reading grade, and simplistically thinking, we would lower our prison population and recidivism rate. So, you know, I mean, we're just hearing the Department of Education here, but, you know, some of us are going to hear corrections later on, and we're trying to make things work as a body, as a whole. And it seems like that would be something that is very important to all of us. And perhaps that's kind of stumped here in why we're not doing more. You know, we're talking about not funding the early learning programs at a higher rate than we thought we were going to be doing before. You know, looking at that as, you know, all the different ways that you can reach students and children, you know, because, well, if they're more successful, it's cheaper to put them through college than it is to house them in prison. So, you know, I think we're all asking that question.
Thank you. Through the chair, I'm recognizing the error of my example by comparing apples to oranges in two different assessments. Our students don't suddenly tank in fourth grade. They, if we continue to use the SBA, they continue to study. You know, it's just there's a different assessment out there that is saying something different. So I apologize for trying to compare two things with the same tool.
I'm not sure apology is necessary. It's kind of not even an apt comparison, in my opinion. Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. been a large emphasis to try and entice students to go to college for college degree. And then when I shared the special Indian education earlier, the numbers didn't count out very well for the amount of students who actually started high school. About of all students who started high school, 60% graduation rate was averaging.
About half of those students attempted to go on to higher education. About 28% completed either the first 2 years program in a certificate or an associate style degree. Out of that, about 12 to 14% went on to a four-year program. Start to finish, of the students who started high school, about 7 or 8% of those students actually did a four-year program. Now, of all the money that we spend to try and entice students to go to high school, 7 or 8% of all the students who started in high school are actually doing that. Where are we at today on those numbers?
I don't have those numbers off the top of my head, do you? I should be glad.
Somewhere in those boundaries.
So I should be glad to get those from you. But we do recognize that as a concern.
And those numbers sound fairly accurate still?
Sure, those numbers sound fairly accurate. We hope that in two ways, one by raising the bar on our standards and helping our kids learn more in school, and then providing the incentive through the performance scholarship that we really hope to begin to see a change in.
To the chair, I guess that's my point to the huge effort that goes into trying to entice these students to further education. We're reaching so few that actually do a four-year program, and the amount of money that's spent on the college programs with the increases in tuition and at the college level and such. I know that those are pretty staggering numbers when you put them down, and they concern it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So I think school board elections are a lot more important than these elections that we're seeing. That's my opinion. Representative Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, you mentioned that you have fourth and eighth grade testing and that we're a 45th. Is that 45th in fourth grade, or is it 45th in fourth and eighth in the testing?
No, we see a definite increase by the time we get to eighth grade, at least in our rankings compared to other states.
Then what do we go from 45th to what, you know?
I want to say it's 23rd, but we see that both in reading and in math. But that's to my best recollection, and I can surely get that for you. But we do see a significant change moving from fourth to eighth, which is encouraging. It's just disappointing that we're starting at the bottom.
Right. I just want to make clarity of fourth and eighth, so thanks.
Any other questions?
Mr. Chair, sorry.
Representative Garrett.
I guess if we're not going to go the pre-K route and we're going to leave that flat funded, what's the plan for increasing student reading proficiency by fourth grade?
We are statewide. We're working on it's called an RTI model. It's a response to instruction or a response to intervention. And it is a model. It's not a program. It's a model of addressing students' needs where they are. So we're kind of changing our pedagogical strategies, especially in the primary grades, to address needs earlier rather than waiting until we see huge deficiencies. So that's one. We're also hoping to strengthen the skills that kids have when they come into school so that they already come in further ahead than they were.
Just through the chair. But without changing the pre-K funding amounts, and aside from Best Beginnings, which we've been doing for years, which I think is a good program, what are you doing to increase student proficiency before they enter into grade school? You said that's one of the things you're going to do, so
right.
What is it?
Within the parameters that we have, within the funding that we have, if we can continue to get this to support the pre-K program that we have, we anticipate to branch that out, moving it from a pilot model and begin to share that with other districts so that more students get to access those funds. We continue to support Best Beginning, Parents as Teachers, and Head Start programs in our department. We're working on the I Am Ready skills, Ready to Read programs, doing what we can with the tools that we have.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Jewell and Fairclough and Noonan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If I could kind of follow up on that discussion just a touch. And you mentioned some of the program's best beginnings, parents as teachers. In addition to the efforts that we're making through the Department of Education, taken together, and I think we've been doing this maybe for long enough that we should be able to start to measure the results. Are we seeing an improvement as those children are coming into our system, where they're at a little bit higher rate of proficiency? Are we seeing the efforts from the different places starting to bring in the kids at a higher rate?
Through the chair, we do see studies that are done with particular programs and pre and post assessments for those kids that come out. The tool that we have at the kindergarten level, when they come into preschool, it's relatively rudimentary as far as trying to measure growth. And so we don't see the changes in the developmental profile. But with specific programs, there is data in all of those programs to show how kids are performing when they go in and how they perform when they come out. And they're all positive. We're seeing growth in every one of those programs.
Right. So I guess part of my question is getting to the data that's necessary that says best beginnings, parents as teachers, what we're doing here, and those with Head Start, other places. At some point, the efforts that the communities are making together with their different schools, but with parents, through community efforts, here's the data that's coming out through this stuff. And some of it, granted, some of it's going to take some money, but sometimes it isn't always about money to get to the readiness of students. There's places where it's going to take it, and I'm sure there's other places where when you get community involvement and people behind certain things, that's going to make a big difference for those students.
Thank you. Through the chair, I do have just a couple of snippets of data from our pilot, or it's not the pilot now, but our pre-K program. 18% of the children have moved from the bottom two quartiles to the top two. 25% of the children have moved out of the bottom quartile. So we originally had 52% of the kids that are in our pre-K program, over half of them were in the lowest quartile. And we're seeing those students move significantly up. 4% of them show over 2 years of growth. 20% of them show 1 to 2 years of growth. Overall, we're showing 78% of the students have above expected growth. So we're seeing, when we step in and we provide specific services, we are seeing it.
Thank you, Representative Faircloth. Passes. Representative Dugan. Anders, any closing remarks before you embark upon your journey through the subcommittee process?
briefly looking at the 10-year plan for operating.
Oops, it wasn't the pages.
It's very brief. But the 10-year plan, it's a difficult document to use as a driver, something to drive what we do, because things are so tenuous, as you know. But we have looked at a 10-year plan, and we have based it on the best we can on looking at increases in 2015 to 2022, with a BSA increase of $100, anticipating that the performance scholarship would be fully funded and that there would be an inflationary cost for operating costs. Again, those are hard to run a budget on, but I think that they're probably relatively realistic in where we're going. And the last slide is the 10-year plan highlights for the capital projects. The annual construction major maintenance items remain stable, and we anticipate that that this funding for the five schools in the next 4 years will meet the Kasaili settlement. We 14 projects are currently being funded in the capital improvement project, and we will also be looking for funding for the Stratton Library renovation and for full funding for the SLAM project, State Libraries, Archives, and Museums.
Is that the Sheldon Jackson SIPCA project?
Yes, it is.
Why don't you identify that more adequately?
I apologize. Right.
We had to find out, Mr. Armstrong, had to scour and find out where the heck the Stratton project was. And, you know, some people don't want things identified around here, and it shouldn't be the government. You know.
No, it is. We acquired that property a couple of years ago. It was acquired to us. And so we are recognizing the facility is on the edge of the Sheldon Jackson campus in Sitka. And we are looking at least to maintain it as a facility that can be renovated and not allowed to fall into disrepair.
Representative Guerra?
Thomas.
Representative Guerra?
This is at the end.
Commissioner Hanley, can you go back to slide number 19? On the second bullet point, we haven't had a base student allocation increase since the last year of the Palin administration. You don't anticipate asking for one till 2015? Is that what that says?
Through the chair, Representative Garra, normally with the 10-year plan, we have to do it based on trends. We don't specifically know what policies any given administration may or may want to declare in the 10-year plan. So we could go back historically and say over X amount of years there were so many increases in the BSA. And so this is just a flat-out projection on what could be anticipated, and that's really all it is. There's nothing hidden in there. It's just based on historical references on what could be anticipated for the future.
I promise the final question on this, Representative.
Mr. Chair.
We have done a couple off-budget increases for pre-K, but those get reversed the next year when they don't show up again, so we're still at the same level of funding as the prior year. Right now, the governor's budget is the same per-student level of funding as 2 years ago. How do you plan on increasing student achievement when you're proposing a budget that school districts are telling us is going to result in teacher layoffs?
Through the chair, we're going to continue to do the best we can with the funding we have. Is more funding the answer? Is there a direct correlation funding to student achievement? Not directly. But can you continue to maintain the services that you have with funding decreases? Not really. So we're going to continue to focus on our mission, continue to focus on our core services, support districts the best we can with the funding that's there.
Thank you. Representative Thomas.
Thank you. Yeah, Commissioner, in regards to the same discussion on your graph 4 and F, apologize, I was gone, I was on a mission here. When you talk about the revenues from the state, and I've said it each year, is that maybe we have to do it this year where we can, is put the TERS payment into the Department of Education that we make as a state, so that people will sit there and say, well, you haven't put anything into our budget lately, and maybe if we put that big number at the bottom, maybe they'll realize that, hey, we do pay more than just education. We're paying your retirement above the 22 percentile, and you know, we're actually doing a lot more. And it really, and I think it kind of bothers me when people say we're doing enough or not doing anything. And also, just for the record, in my understanding, the cost differential goes into the budget again this year, so we did add money in there for the cost differential, and it's the final year. And so we might talk about giving you the money to pay into TERS, so then it'll show us into your foundation formula what we're paying. That, or maybe we like get the school districts to make their own payments, but somehow we got to let them realize that, hey, we are paying something here, and massive amounts of money. So anyway, we'll talk about that later.
Right. And that amount is the projection. Significant. That amount is just going up over the next 7 years.
What is it, 800 billion? Mm-hmm. I believe, I have no idea, it's 300 some for this year, so that's big.
A little bit more than a BSA bump?
Yes.
Does look like there any other questions?
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Benjamin.
Are we going to have every agency come forward with a similar format like this in terms of tenure? Look forward, would kind of give us a glimpse of what some of the needs are going to be. And you know, as I read down this line here, I'm counting at least $50 million a year additional, and my math, I'm sure, is off. But are we going to get that same picture from all the other agencies, too?
Well, I think it's the expectation of this committee. Departments that come here and just want to give us a bunch of pictures are going to get a lot more questions. So I think they're OMB people and listening. It's the bailiwick of Mr. Thomas, my co-chair here. I think if you want to get a lot of questions, a lot of probing and probing, come here and not give the answers that this committee has in the format that we've asked for through both legislation and through direct dialogue. So, am I speaking out of turn, Mr. Chairman?
Very fine.
Okay. Representative Jewell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I looked through the 10-year operating and capital budget, and you know, there seems to be, I mean, even the operating budget is and capital budget, you know, reflect a little bit of a tightening and maintaining the budgets as they are, being frugal. Are you, through your department, having any discussions around the concept of regional boarding schools as looking down the line? Because, you know, when I consider down the line a few years, I can't see how we can not be having that discussion. And I just wonder whether or not that's on your radar.
Through the Chair, Representative Jewell, that's been a great conversation that I've had with several communities, most recently with Gloria O'Neill, the Cook and Tribal, and some models that they're looking at. I see that as being a very valuable model to offer students more and still remain in their own, if not their own direct community, but in their own, you know, their same part of the state. It's a discussion that I believe has a lot of power, primarily if it comes first from the local communities, because they recognize the need, they recognize what they want in the education, and they drive that discussion. So I've been very supportive of conversations that I've had with anybody that wants to talk about that. I think there's probably an erroneous aspect to it if it comes down from the state where me from Juneau says, you know, I know what's best. You should put a school right here. Because there will be some unintended consequences of that. You know, there will be kids that move in there which may close down schools in smaller communities. So there may be some dynamics there. Hugely powerful conversation. I think it's a great model, especially as it comes to local communities.
And a follow-up to that, and I think, you know, you're having discussions, although they may not be the traditional Manichcom and or Galena model, Narvik out in Bethel, the magnet school out in Kotzebue. There are some that are heading in that direction, kind of sort of, in different ways. And I think there's certainly a lot of interest, but generally the lifting has to be done on the legislative level as opposed to being supported by the administration. And that is in part. Kind of the basis of my question. It's one thing to have the conversation. It's something else, again, to have during that conversation to have the administration help with the lifting.
Thank you, Representative Jewell. I'm very well aware of that, especially the one in Bethel. Tremendously powerful program. Students coming in for a semester at a time to gain the courses that they would not get in their local communities, giving them access to the NSET program and walking into the university system, sometimes as, you know, with their calculus courses already under their belt and taking courses with sophomores and juniors. And a very powerful model.
Representative Thomas.
Thank you. I'll do the closing comments and we'll take a short break and bring on the Department of Revenue. Just wanted to point out that from day one, the session started, that we've been pointing out to the public, that at the present rate of growth in the operating budget, in 2 years, we will be in a deficit. It's not been picked up by the press, but I saw an editorial in Fairbanks, and this is it's serious. I mean, Representative Edmund is right. You know, we look out 10 years, we'll be broke. And so we have to let people know that look at your budgets and start looking, you know, that, you know, in a few years, we won't be broke, but, you know, we start going into the reserves that we have now. And I know the pressure that we have is to spend. And we're trying to maintain as we go out there. And I just want to make that point. We'll say that depending on the size of the audience, because each department brings a different following. But in this one, I think it's important to know that in 2 years, we'll be at a deficit. So if we let the budget go to 7% like it's been growing the last 7 years. So with that, we'll take a short break. And I want to thank you, Commissioner Hanley. You did a good job this year again. Thank you. Okay, good afternoon again. Thanks for that little break. Continue the excitement, and trust me, this afternoon we have Department of Revenue, Commissioner Brian Butcher, and Director Gary Bennett, Burnett, Division of Administrative Services, and Support Services behind them, and on lifelines on the phone and everything else. But anyway, welcome at this time. Commissioner, we'll turn it over to you. And like I told you, I don't have an appointment till 5:30, so if you feel like you need more time.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll see what I can do.
Okay, but you might.
For the record, my name is Brian Butcher, Commissioner for the Department of Revenue, and with me is our Administrative Services Director, Jerry Burnett. We'll be touching on a number of things on a fairly high level, and if the committee has specific questions, we're happy to dig down into whatever you'd like. On page 2, it shows the mission of the Department of Revenue is to collect, distribute, and invest funds for public purposes. The four major areas, not counting the corporations, are the tax division, which enforces the tax laws of the state and collects and accounts for tax revenues, the Treasury Division, in charge of managing and investing state funds, the Permanent Fund Dividend Division, which administers the PFD program and distributes the annual dividend to eligible Alaskans, and Child Support Services Division, which collects and distributes child support to custodial parents. I'd also like to say I'm particularly excited to work with you this year on missions and measures. It's something I've spent many years of my life working on back in the 90s with Governor Parnell, when he was the chairman of the Senate, co-chairman of the Senate Finance Committee, as well as Representative Mulder when he was the co-chair of the House Finance Committee. And so we're going to have quite a few members of the department participating this Saturday, and we're really looking forward to it. You will get a very proactive, positive engagement from this department on that issue.
Chair, child support, if I might, Mr. Chair. Is that... where are you having your success? Are you redirecting funds that originate with the state, or are you actually going out and catching people that are working in the underground economy and avoiding it? Or is it just as simple as we're catching more dividends and other state payments?
The combination of all, if I could, to the chair of Representative Stoltz, the Child Support Services Division has a number of tools in its toolbox for that. And so to the extent that it's gone up in the last couple of years, our collections have actually gone up net of dividends. So it's not just that, that we're collecting more dividends. But we do catch people's tax refunds. We look at bank accounts. We found some money in a safe deposit box this year. So and it's a variety of things.
There's a property officer here at APD that I just am proud of. One of my constituents, she actually checks the CSED and makes sure we're not dealing with those required boys to begin with. So it's any dollar that gets there from that source is even better, because that probably was not, you're going to get too much blood out of that stone.
Yeah, yes, Mr. Chairman, and we'll touch on it briefly later on in our presentation, but one of the major changes to our department in the last fiscal year was the development of a criminal investigations unit. And it was $1.6 million interagency, so we were just transferring the funds from other divisions to focus specifically on this. So we weren't increasing the revenues we needed for it, but it was to take the criminal investigators from child support, from permanent fund, tax, treasury, and they're all working together now. And even though we're only in our first year, it seems to be working pretty well. As an example, there's certain times of year where fraud is higher with permanent fund than with others, and it gives the investigators an opportunity not only to benefit from each other's information, but also to be able to add extra focus in times where there might be a little slower period for one division and a little busier period for another. So we think it's working pretty well. Touching a little bit on page three in the results in the fiscal year 2011, you see the tax division, 98.5% of known taxpayers filed tax returns and made their payments in a timely manner. In Treasury, the returns for 9 of the 10 funds under our fiduciary responsibility exceeded the applicable one-year target return. And the one fund that missed it was
the Retiree Health Insurance Long-Term Care Fund, which earned 21.77%. And the benchmark was 21.9. So.
And as a department, we did a slight bit better than the permanent fund this year, so we were pretty pleased with that in terms of our long-term investment.
Question. Representative Castillo.
Thank you, Commissioner. My question has to do with the target returns. How do you set those, and how do we find out what they are? Is it in your presentation?
Through the chair, Representative Costello, they're set on each individual fund that has an asset allocation that's targeted, and there's a set of funds. We can get that information to you. We don't have it in the presentation, but for each of the funds, there's a set of benchmarks.
Focusing on the permanent fund dividend division, of the 144,000 plus eligibility cases open, 88% were reviewed by September 15th and were either closed, resolved, or awaiting information from the applicant. So one of the real focuses of the division over the last probably 5 years was becoming far more timely on the information that is both needed and then gotten back to by the applicant, so we don't have the multi-year waiting period that happened, which probably your offices were about 15 years ago. And in child support, collections of child support have increased 3.53%, resulting in $3.3 million more in disbursement from the previous fiscal year.
Representative Dugan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wasn't exactly sure where in this presentation you asked this question, so I'll just ask it now. There has been, for the entire time I've been in the legislature, problems with filling the auditor positions, which in turn have put us in a position where we can't really audit income tax returns, particularly for the oil companies. Can you tell me what that situation is like now?
Yes, through the chair, Representative Dugan. We are as hired up as we've ever been at the Department of Revenue that I'm aware of. We are fully funded with our auditors, with the exception of one master auditor position that's going to be the real focus in the first 6 months of this year to try to get filled. Two commercial analysts that were not filled when we were in front of you a year ago have been filled. We didn't have a tax director a year ago, and that's also been filled. So we are almost at 100% in terms of the folks that are doing the work.
Mr. Chairman, if I might, so what has been the result with the backlog?
Through the chair, Representative Dugan, when we finished the first year of the switch from gross to net tax, the PPT of 2006-2007, we are now, we're on the 2007, which were completed in 2008. And the pace seems to be considerably faster than it was in the first year that we were doing the huge switch from gross to net. So we anticipate over the next few years to really begin to get caught up on our auditing. However, that pace will continue to be slower than it could be until we have our new data management system up.
Thank you. Thank you. And can you tell us what the results of that have been? Are we getting more money than we thought we should? Are we getting less? How's it going?
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Dugan, I don't know that we have a definitive explanation of whether or not we received more or less. We'll get back to you on that. In the conversations I had with the auditors as they were wrapping up the first switch from gross to net, they seemed pleased that most of what they were going through auditing lined up. However, a lot of it had been audited, had a smaller amount of auditing already put into it. We audit and dig into the numbers before we ever pay out a tax credit, as well as going through the initial return. So it's not a matter of taking information in blindly and then paying out credits, as an example. It's just kind of crossing the T's and dotting the I's on what's already been done. But I'll see if I can't get you a more detailed explanation.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Stoltz.
And I think, you can correct me if I'm wrong, it could be that these top-flight auditors won't work for the state unless they're represented by a collective bargaining unit with adequate representation.
Mr. Chairman,
no.
Many of
the... No, that's tongue-in-cheek. We'll just...
I could go on and on about our fun with the auditor.
Representative
Kira. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I heard what I thought were two different answers, and they were probably the same, and I misunderstood. You said you've audited the first year we went from gross to net, so that was PPT. Have you done a full year's audit of any tax returns under ACES?
Through the chair, Representative Kira, that's what we're working on right now. We're going through that as we speak.
So, no.
No, we have not completed one, correct? Going to page 4, touching a little bit on the authorities and corporations. As most of you know, the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation, the Alaska Improvement Fund, the Rural Health Trust, the Municipal Bond Bank Authority, and the Alaska Natural Gas Development Authority are all authorities and corporations that are under the Department of Revenue, although to some degree they operate with somewhat separately with the Board of Directors, although their funding is all approved by the legislature.
Representative Fairclough.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to let you know, and I will make a phone call directly, but I'd like to meet with Alaska Housing Finance in my office prior to subcommittee meetings starting.
This slide gives a good 7-year look back at department activities, where we were in FY05, and then where we were at the completed FY11. As you can see, we collect considerably more by the tax division now than we did in FY05. Funds under management have also over doubled. The number of permanent fund dividends have also gone up considerably. And the number of child support cases have increased by 4%, while the amount of child support distributed has increased by 15%. So a little more cases, a lot more money.
Representative Fairclough.
Thank you. I just wanted to let you know that my staff advised me I have an appointment on Wednesday. Thank you.
Give your staff a raise.
Slide 6 gives you a good idea of how the growth in state funds, what has happened over the last 7 years. The red line is constitutional budget reserve. The blue line is Jafonzi, which is general fund and other non-segregated investments. And the pool that you have of the general fund. And then the green is combined. So you can see how the amount of money under supervision of the Treasury Division has gone up considerably over the last 7 years.
We have any inquiries from other states to borrow money from you?
Through the chair, Representative Holmes, no, we don't. Although we just got a
Representative Dugan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I never pass an opportunity to show how little I know about this process. Could you tell me what Jafonzi means?
Sure. Through the chair, Representative Dugan, it's general fund, GEF, O, or F, and then other non-segregated investments, which includes all of the separate pools of money.
SDR, the public school fund, you know, the forward funding for education pool, the
PCE.
No, the PCE is separate, but the...
That doesn't become a household word.
But, you know, but all those other pools, there's 100 different accounts.
Permanent fund earnings reserve.
What's that?
For the chair, permanent fund earnings reserve is part of that.
No. Yeah. So, but we have some money in there that's the capital corp, the Alaska Housing Capital Corporation funds, and those types of monies are all things that are available to the legislature to spend, need to be fairly liquid, and are all invested in the pool.
So, if I might, so this is the money that's available for the legislature to spend if we...
Through the chair to Representative Dugan, there's money in here that isn't available for you to spend, but for the most part, this is money that...
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Costello.
Commissioner, questions about the constitutional budget reserve, and I'm curious, what kind of investments do we have in that fund, and what's the rate of return that we get on that fund?
Through the chair, Representative Costello, it is split out between what is invested short-term and what is invested longer-term. And the breakdown hasn't been changed in the last few years that I'm aware of.
This is what we need on the main account. This is what we need on the sub-account.
Okay. On the main account, which is invested short-term for liquidity in case it's needed, the last fiscal year was 2.64% it was earned on. And the funds invested longer term, similar to what the permanent fund is, was at 21.13%.
Thank you.
Representative Fairclough.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That was part of my question, that the money that were being shown on the graph on page 6 had both short and long-term strategies, as well as different interest rates. Can you tell me the percentage of how that splits, not necessarily at any one particular time, because I know it's going to change, but in approximation?
Through the chair, Representative Fairclough, as of the end of the year, it's real close to 50-50 between in the Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund, which was a bit over $10 billion. Mm-hmm. It was just about half in the sub-account and half in the main account. We can give you the exact numbers, but I don't have them with me. But it's about 50-50, so there's about roughly $5 billion that's short-term and $5 billion that's longer.
With the credit rating that the state of Alaska has, is there any advantage? I believe some municipal governments do this, so that you can move most of your assets into a long-term strategy at 21% to actually borrow the money, since the money's available on the open market right now from somewhere between 1% to 3.75%. So we lost or... could have lost some 20% of earnings if we would have just borrowed the money from someone else that was taking a lower rate of return and invested ours in long-term strategies. Are we doing any of that? Or
Through the chair, Representative Faircloth, with the volatility that's been going on in the market over the last, pretty much since fiscal year 11 ended, we've been kind of taking the wait-and-see approach a little bit, because in September, if we'd have moved anything in the beginning of the fiscal year, we'd have had a multi-billion dollar loss. And so we've worked with our advisors as well as people in the department to try to determine when is the best time to make decisions like that.
And what's the label? I didn't want to say it out loud. I know there's a word for it. When you borrow money, arbitrage is what I thought it was. But yeah, okay, thank you.
But to, if I could a little bit, Mr. Chairman, to talk a little bit about the benefit of the AAA upgrade that we received from Standard & Poor's. Angela Rodell, who is our new deputy commissioner, maybe Angela can stand up for right here, started with us in September. she began looking a little bit in some of our old bond deals and looked at the 2003s and said we could refund them at what we expected to be a net present value savings of about $20-21 million. We just went to market with it last week, and that assessment was done before we got upgraded to AAA. We sold the bonds last Wednesday, and we actually ended up earning a $27 million savings for the state in net present value. So between that and helping to get a AAA upgrade, Angela's been joking that she's ready to go now. She's come in. She's done positive for the state, and you know, I can't go anywhere but down from here. But I've assured her that that's only the start of bigger and better things. But that was an almost immediate benefit of how well Alaska was being looked at nationally when we went to market, because the more popular you are and the better buy they think you are, the much smaller spread you have to pay. And we got a very low spread, and we were able to save a considerable amount of money. We also had quite a few million sold to Alaskans, which is always nice to get retail out there, to get Alaskans investing in Alaska. And was it $26 million of the $175 million were sold to Alaskans, which made us quite happy because there's a lot of value in Alaska bonds, and it was good to see Alaskans investing in their own state.
Representative Stoltz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We had the Carlson money held in escrow. Is that in any kind of earning capacity at all? Is that...
Through the Chair, Representative Stoltz, I believe that was actually held external to the state. It was held in a fund in a bank. So it has been earning interest, but I couldn't tell you what the rate is.
You see, we got out of that $83 million, and we're getting 0.08 or whatever.
That's 11% compounded. Really?
I was just looking to see if we'd find Representative Thomas a little more money.
So to real briefly touch on page 7, the annual growth rate for the department's been about 6.6% since FY05, which is, as you can see, a little bit under what the state average has been, and our GF budget is under 1% of what the state's GF budget is. This separates out our FY13 budget request by fund source. As you can see, by far the largest fund source is permanent fund corporate receipts at over a third. We also have a little under a quarter is federal funds, and then you see to a lesser HFC's corporate receipts, corporation operations, armed board pension funds, and then general funds being 9% and designated general funds. This slide 9 separates out the department by program. You can see that the largest is the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation, and at 119, a little over 119 million, and at 94 million, the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. So the corporations are quite large when you look at the big picture in terms of what the Department of Revenue oversees. And then with our tax division being at 16.2 million. Treasury being at $10 million, and so on. The review on the current fiscal year, as I mentioned earlier, establishing the criminal investigations unit was $1.6 million transferred interagency receipts inside the department to centralize them. And then we began work on the tax revenue management system, as most of you are probably aware. You appropriated a little under $35 million last year. And I'll touch a little bit on where we are to date with TRMS, the Tax Revenue Management System. We brought a third-party project manager on board this last summer to assist on writing an RFP to help select a contractor. We expect to release our RFP late next month, early March. The implementation contractor should be on board by the end of the summer, and we'll be implementing a commercial off-the-shelf system. The two varieties you could look at would be building your own or having an off-the-shelf system and doing some tweaks and adjustments on that, and we determined that system, which is incidentally what most states use, would not only save us money, But it ultimately, in the long term, would probably be a money saver as well, because there would be people that would be able to work on it as opposed to building something up internally, which sometimes makes sense, but oftentimes you end up with a system that you run out of people that can do the work on it. And we think that this long term will give much bigger bang for the buck for the department and for the state. We'll have a phased implementation of the tax division's 22 tax systems, where we'll work on oil, and the busier and the larger dollar amount tax systems first. And as the time goes on, we'll eventually incorporate all 22 tax systems. And we expect the timeline for full implementation to be 2 to 5 years. I certainly would love to expedite that time, but we've spent quite a bit of time talking to other states that have done this, and if there's one thing they really emphasized to us more than anything else, it was make sure you take your time to do everything right and get your best people on it, because this is far too important and far too large transition to try to rush into. So we're doing the best we can as quickly as we can, but it's going to take a little while.
Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had a question back on page 9. We had $436,000 for Alaska Natural Gas Development Authority. What's the administration of revenue's intent with the authority for this year or the coming years? Are you going to continue funding them, or what is their job description going to be?
Through the chair, Representative Newman, as most of you know, the Executive Director Harold Hines resigned. They have an interim executive director. They are in the FY13 budget. I don't know, what the situation is going forward. We're just moving along as if everything's the same. But I know that the governor has had discussions about bringing a lot of the different agencies that are working on the gas line and other issues, certainly to work together. I know you've probably heard from DNR Commissioner Dan Sullivan that one of the first interesting things he observed when he came in was that we had all these different agencies that all seemed to be working on slight variations of the same thing, whether it's ANGA or AGDC or GIA, APP. And one thing that Commissioner Sullivan and I have very much tried to do is begin to bring everybody in the room so everybody communicates with everybody else, so we don't end up having one agency spending money on the same thing another agency has already spent money on. And I can't say where it's going to go in the future, but what I can say is we're looking at making sure that the information sharing gets better and that we focus on not wasting money or potentially spending the same dollar. Now I will ask Jerry to focus a little bit on our specific budget changes that are coming up in FY13.
Okay, so FY13, we don't have a lot of exciting things to talk about in our budget, but we're asking for $25,900 GF, the Mental Health Trust, and that's to reduce there are five people in the long-term care ombudsman's office, and they want to have a zero vacancy, so this puts them up to zero. Also, let's develop an online learning management system, small increment. Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation is asking for $340,000 in corporate receipts, permanent fund earnings, to provide performance-based salary increases and increase their due diligence. They're not on a contract with their employees, so you're making market-based salary adjustments. Treasury Division is asking for additional funds to manage the Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund because it's grown in value, and for the Power Cost Equalization Endowment Fund because the legislature put more money in it last year. So,
does that mean they have to hire extra people?
No, this is not hiring people, but
they're just going to pay more.
Each of these have some external managed index funds that are managed with external fees, and there's also some allocation within the departments because Treasury manages a whole bunch of different funds, some of which are trust funds, pension funds, and so the costs of those have to be allocated on a cost allocation plan to each of the funds properly. And then Permanent Fund Corp as you know, in FY11, earned about 21%, so it has increased values, and they're asking for additional funding for external management fees.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Dugan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The Constitutional Budget Reserve management costs, is that a function of the Constitutional Budget Reserve getting larger, or what is that?
Here, it's a direct function of the Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund getting larger. And if you'll recall, at the end of FY10, the Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund was fully funded, and so the legislature no longer had an obligation to it. Since then, it's been managed with general fund dollars so that there's no draws out of the Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund. So,
okay. Thank you.
How many billion we have to save 300 billion? We could save this, right?
Right.
Spending
money.
And
then
we go down and we would save us some money, huh?
Exactly. We'd save us some money.
Okay, the next slide is our fiscal year 13 capital request. As with the tax division, previous year we funded a new modernization of their IT system. This is a request for child support case management modernization. It's a legacy system currently operating on the state's mainframe, and the people who know how to program it are probably older than I am. And so, you know, modern technology, this is a look. It's a federally approved program looking at it. The federal government will pay 66%. The state will pay 34% of the cost of this. The next one is just an ongoing computer replacement within the child support division. And the last one, the third one in child support, is an interactive voice response system. That's a call center. That needs to be modernized. The system that they're currently using is not being supported anymore. And they do have a fairly high volume of calls there. So the next one is $50,000 at permanent fund earnings to install, I believe, Cat 6 wiring in the Gold Belt building for the permanent fund offices so that they can be more efficient. It's not a big thing, and it kind of disappears in their budget, but you know, it has to be called out for you. Alaska Housing Finance Corporation has total projects that are $109 million general fund, $850,000 other funds, and $11,800,000 federal funds, including weatherization, money for the Alaska Gas Line Development Corp, home energy rebate program, homeless assistance, and a number of projects that are for their internal programs to maintain the buildings that they own, et cetera, which I haven't called out here as a whole list. And then the last few pages are on our 10-year expenditure projection. Our baseline assumptions are very much like those of the Department of Education in terms of applying a 2.75% annual inflation factor. We don't include personal services and investment management fees in that, but we did try to model the values of the permanent fund, the pension funds, et cetera, over the next 10 years for the custody and investment management fees using anticipated rates of return and market values in the revenue sources book. Alaska Housing and the permanent fund are large contributors to our 10-year plan, and so using the same type of assumptions, here with the same inflation factor, corporations earnings resume pre-recession levels, weatherization, total programs, $100 million to maintain the current program, permanent fund growing at their and it's an external investment manager fees, looking at a projected cost of 26 basis points in the total fund value. So just
you know, looking at a graph of ours, kind of interesting little bump there in the beginning for all funds or general funds, and that's primarily due to two things, the inclusion of the total cost of our expected modernization of the child support IT system and the AGDC capital costs, which are general fund, because they assume that they go forth to the first date of decision making in AGDC in the 10-year projection. And then when you go to operating, you'll see that bump is taken out, and for all funds, you have a slope because the permanent fund, the retirement funds, et cetera, are growing, and other programs have some growth. If you look at general fund, it's not quite flat, but again, our general fund budget growth over the past several years has been below that of the state, and you know, we don't expect to have new tax types coming on, and you know, most our biggest general fund expenditure in operating is the tax division, and the second biggest is the match for the child support. So, two programs that are very flat over time. And at that, I think it's just a wrap up.
Yeah, just touching a little bit on what we've already mentioned. The tax division is actively engaged in increasing the efficiency of their tax administration and timely access to information to assist policy decisions made by the legislature. We've been working on putting together a five-year look back on trying to tie what our tax credits have been being paid out and what the breakout has been on what we've been getting from it from the industry on oil. And that's something that we have the potential to give a presentation to the committee on at a future date. Talking about our prudent investment practices, we're the state's largest investment manager, a little bit larger than the permanent fund as of today anyway. And we've just received a AAA upgrade by S&P, so we're very excited about that, helping us get the lowest cost of borrowing. We've continually worked at the permanent fund, dividend division, and the child support services division to improve the business practices and to be as in touch with the public as we possibly can. And if you have any issues with those programs, I know they're frequent constituent issues, and you don't get a quick turnaround on it, please let me know. But I feel like we're doing pretty well there. And our corporations receive national recognition for their exemplary program management and fiscal solvency. And they all provide valuable services to the state. We're quite proud to have them in the department.
Representative Dugan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Some incredible optimist has introduced a bill in the House to take $10 billion and move it out of the general fund, essentially, into the permanent fund. And we don't have to go into this now, but I would like to know from the department what problems that might create and how those problems might be solved. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Absolutely, Representative.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Somebody want to make my little speech about the growth of the budget?
I do.
Okay. I feel like my meetings, I have a Pete Eckman in my office.
I was going to read my mind because I was going to start out by saying echoing.
Okay. I will let you do that. That's what I said about Pete's.
Echoing co-chair, we learned from David Teal and read about it in Dermot Cole's piece recently that at the current rate of government growth of 7.8%, we are looking at operating in the red by 2015, and our cash reserves are depleted by 2025. So how will the department, I mean, how are you responding to that kind of information? Are you, you know, looking at addressing certain funds in a different way, adjusting your target returns? You know, a lot of these funds were created for a rainy day, and it looks like the rainy day is within sight.
Yes, through the chair, Representative Costello. As we've mentioned previously, general fund-wise, we're very small. We have really worked hard to show very minimal growth in terms of not just our general fund spending, but state employees. And as well as certainly we have something that most departments don't, in that if we do our jobs and do them well, and of course it doesn't all depend on us, the stock market and everything else, but prudent management can mean more funds for the state, and doing a good job in the tax division and working through the audits can also be a financial benefit to the state. So we see the value we play in potentially moving that red line further in the distance than it already is.
Well, you know, something, and I'd asked about this earlier, but with half of the CBR receiving like a 2.6% growth rate, and yet we have, you know, ADA, which requires, I think, a 13% rate of return. Is the department going to recommend that we possibly invest our money in elsewhere and have our money work for us in ways that we haven't thought of in the past?
Through the chair, Representative Costello, that is something we're looking at. In fact, I've had discussions in taking a look at, on a wider scale, of potentially how we might invest our money specifically to be more diversified, because as the show of the CBR ramp-up line shows you, until relatively recently, we had a very small amount of money. And the way the CBR used to be invested was $500 million was invested long-term and the rest was invested short-term to be as liquid as possible. We now don't have those restrictions on us that we did before because we've got enough money that the liquidity concerns aren't as important. However, we want to make sure we do the right things with, be prudent and be conservative with the investments because, as I mentioned before, with the drop that just occurred in September, if you pick the wrong time to move something from short-term to long-term, and this happened a few years ago where the department moved, I can't remember how many billions.
About 4.1.
Yeah, $4 billion from short-term investment to long-term investment the summer before that 2008. It literally, in our lifetime, you couldn't have picked a worse timing for the department to move from short-term to long-term. And a couple billion just, poof, disappeared. And we've built it back. It's back to where it was before, like most of the funds that really took hits in 2008, 2009. But it just emphasizes that being prudent and being diversified, similar to the permanent fund, is the way we move forward.
Follow up. Do you have an opinion on what's the best approach in terms of the unfunded liability? I mean, is it, in your mind, better to pay it off now or, you know, accept these growing payments into the future at a time when we're also addressing some other concerns?
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Costello, I'm on the ARM board, and over the last two meetings in particular, we've really focused a lot more on what is the best way to move forward in dealing with the unfunded liability. And in my mind, there's not a specific silver bullet to it. They all have their pros and their cons, but it's certainly something I look forward to a good example is, you know, you could take $2 billion and say, well, we have $2 billion, why don't we stick it in there? But if the timing's wrong, you could lose almost all of that money just that quickly. And so there's a lot of things that need to be looked into moving forward. I mean, right now we're on a specific this amount of money every year, and it grows every year, and that's an answer for it. But ultimately that's something that the policymakers and the administration really need to work together to figure out how best to move forward.
Thank you.
Representative Fairclough.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On the ARM board, is there discussion in the TERS program? I've heard that that system is a bit more unbalanced because of the 20-year and out provision there. Are we doing something with new teachers coming into the system so that that system isn't so out of balance with rates of return to be able to fund it?
Through the chair, Representative Faircloth, the discussions we have had at the ARM board level have been broader, I mean, you know, the switch from defined benefits to defined contributions affected TERS the same as affected PERS. And I guess, I don't know, maybe the Department of Administration would have more insight into that. We've been looking at it on the ARM board as kind of a big picture. They're split out, and we have the columns, and we deal with it, but we've been discussing kind of how to move forward more on a big picture collective issue than we really have. I'm sure there have been committees that have had more focused breakdown of PERS compared to TERS, because you're correct about that. There is a discrepancy between the two.
Mr. Chairman, the only reason I bring that particular issue for the legislature out as a highlight is because when we heard from our own legislative finance, they said a conversation around a $2 billion front-loaded cost could be very beneficial. But when the co-chair asked, or maybe it was Representative Dugan asked, does that include then salvation for the TERS system? And the answer was no. And we asked from what that particular salvation along the same kind of thought process was. It was $4 billion for that system. And so it seems like there is an inequity in solving those issues, even though they might be a combined solution. The problem appears worse in the TERS system.
Through the chair, Representative Fairclough, one of the reasons that the TERS and PERS are unbalanced that way is because when the legislature and the House Bill 125 changed the funding, the employer cost in PERS is 22% that you're paying, you're contributing. So the $2 billion is helping. You're paying only 12.5% in TERS. So you're not making, the employer is not making the same type of contribution up front. So the you have a bigger legislative contribution. So that rate to the employer, which is differentiated, is going to have a large difference on that.
Mr. Chairman, if I might, it certainly highlights your earlier comments with the Department of Education in front of us, where we were saying we were making up the difference by 22%, and that's not accurate. It's from 12%, 12.5% up to the 40%, I think, that we were briefed on last year that we're picking up the payments on.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman.
Tomorrow we'll take up HESS, and I will take all afternoon. Of course, it's the largest department we have. So 1:30 tomorrow, finance will be back in. And thank you all for attending. So adjourned.